Okay, everyone, it's 9 o'clock, so we may as well begin. Thank you all so much for being here this morning. My name is Krishna, and I'm the outreach coordinator at the University of Chicago's Center for Middle Eastern Studies. I'm joined by Katherine Kranz, the Assistant Director of Graduate Career Development at UChicago Grad. We're delighted to present the Global Risk and Intelligence Panel to you all this morning. Before we begin, just please note that we have several other panels occurring today. You can see them all on this next slide. Yep, right here. And kind of a special shout out to our keynote panel at 12 o'clock today, which will feature the University of Chicago's Provost, Kai-Yi Li, as well as Vice Provost Daniel Ababa and Vice Provost Jason Merchant. We encourage you all to attend, and you can find registration information at the link in the bottom right, grad.uchicago.edu/graduecon. For those of you who are new to Zoom webinars, you'll note that there is both a chat feature and a Q&A feature, and we just like to draw the distinction. If you experience a technical issue during the webinar, please leave a message in the chat function, and Katherine and I will monitor that and get back to you as soon as possible. If you have a question for panelists, however, related to the content of the panel, please type it into the Q&A function. And you will also be able to upvote other participants' questions through the Q&A window. So last but not least, I'd like to just briefly introduce our panelists today. We have Maria Derbani, Julia Reuter, Claire Gaynor, Taylor White, and our moderator today is David Benson. So I'm gonna turn it over to David now, but thank you so much for all being here, and I hope you enjoy the panel.
Yeah, I got to get used to unmuting these things. I want to welcome everybody. I'm glad that you all can make it here today. Let's go ahead, as we discussed earlier, and if you can remember the order that you were in on that slide, I believe it was Maria, Julia, Taylor, and Claire. Each go ahead, and we've been given a number of questions to answer. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about what you do for your in your field, and then how people can prepare. And then once we've all gone through that, I'll introduce myself a little bit more, and then we can open up for questions. Sound reasonable?
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Hey guys, my name is Maria Derbani. As you might have saw, I am currently a risk intelligence advisor for McDonald's. I was a student within the social sciences division, particularly within the Center for Middle Eastern Studies program, and just graduated in June. So still relatively new to the workforce. On a day-to-day basis right now, my world at McDonald's revolves around coronavirus, as I'm sure many of the other panelists are also dealing with quite a bit. However, when coronavirus is not the priority, we do quite a range of different risk-associated topics for McDonald's. So what's unique for my particular position is that it's specific primarily on the brand and reputation risk management, but we do everything from enterprise risk management, physical security, executive protection, but again, primarily focused on brand and reputation.
Great. Right. And how would people go about preparing for that job, or what would you recommend people do?
It really depends. I actually became aware of the position through a colleague at the University of Chicago. So I was working at CPost during the time. But honestly, the private security intel world is very, very new. So there's several professional associations that you can just find online. Just look up private security professional associations. So definitely reading up a bit more on that. Networking, of course, is super important. But just being willing and able to, you know, have the confidence to ask someone in a particular career field, hey, I don't know you, but would you like to chat for 15 minutes just to discuss like your career trajectory? Was super helpful. So just networking and reaching out via LinkedIn cold calls, even though that can be somewhat weird, was actually pretty helpful.
Awesome. So Yulia, how about you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, David. Hi, everyone. So my name is Yulia Reuter. My current position is the senior analyst with business risk intelligence at AbbVie, which is a major biopharmaceutical company. So with the company's footprint spanning the world, my primary role is to follow global developments and identify those trends that be they political, socioeconomic, or more traditional security related, like terrorism or crime, that may impact the company's ability to do business in any place around the world. My primary focus and my position is to provide strategic and forward-looking analysis to help stakeholders across the company understand a little better the risks and opportunities associated with many events or with the business environment around the world. I work very closely with different stakeholders across the company, so I primarily support the big decision makers, the executive leadership, the leadership at the affiliate level, as well as crisis management. So, of course, the COVID-19 pandemic is also taking up all of my time currently. In addition to that, I also support the supply chain because we as a pharmaceutical company have the logistics and distribution across the globe. And it's very important for us to be able to deliver medicines to patients. I am the Committee of International Relations grad of 2015, and I previously worked as a consulting intelligence analyst with IGIT, now WorldAware, and I did, prior to that, I worked as a EMEA, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa analyst at Nike, and I also did a couple of internships prior to my first position.
Great. I think that unless you want to add something about how to prepare for this,
Right. I think Maria did provide a good answer. We work in the same field. However, yes, professional associations, I would be happy to provide some of the names as well, because I know there is a professional association specifically for risk intelligence analysts, and it actually accepts students. Students can participate in events. Students can reach out to members, and there's actually a mentorship program. So I think that that's pretty awesome, because that didn't exist when I was looking for that position. So I was actually mostly heard through the grapevine about this great field, and I had to reach out to some people, and then for those connections, I was able to create an understanding of what the role entails, and that was very important for me when applying for jobs, because then I could make a far stronger case for why I would be a good candidate coming out of grad school.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
How about you go ahead and introduce yourself?
David, your mic cut out there. Oh, I think you're muted.
Taylor, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, great. Hey, everyone. My name's Taylor White, and I'm currently an analyst at Hillard Hines. They have a couple different departments, but within that, I'm on the threat and risk violence management department. So pretty much like what that means is that my department handles basically threat assessments. What that means is that basically corporations, companies, they hire us to make sure that their facilities are able to adequately manage any type of like crisis. Usually that entails like, that could be any type of violence, like maybe an employee was let go, maybe there is some kind of issue and then they want to retaliate against the company. So it's really more of a preemptive type of position where we're outfitting basically the company and making sure that they'd be able to prepare for that. And that's just like one aspect of the job. We're also basically, like I said before, our company is hired out by other like corporations, and pretty much 90% of what we do is domestic. So basically, we could do monitoring of POIs. These are usually like high wealth corporations or even high wealth individuals. And we make sure that, like I said, physically their premises are safe. And if there's someone in particular that they, you know, have been making threatening comments online, we monitor that them physically, or we monitor them online. So those are just kind of like two aspects of what we do. We also do kind of, we review police departments to make sure they're up to date on all their like practices, at least when that comes to kind of their reach within the community, make sure they're kind of like up to date with everything. We also do security risk management, which is really more like the physical and technical aspect of things. So like I said, with corporations or high wealth companies, we go out to their homes, make sure technically their systems can't be penetrated via like hacking, and then also like physical entry. And pretty much like Maria said, I'd say as far as preparing for like this type of work, you know, it's kind of hard, you know, because there's not a lot of internships, you know, that you can do. But I would say one internship that was very helpful for me as far as like acquiring this job was, it's called CPOST, and Center for Protection of Security and Threats. And that's that is an internship that you could do here at UChicago. I worked there for about maybe a year, and I'd say that was probably one of the most helpful pieces of experience that was able to give me a little bit of experience and dip my foot kind of like into this, you know, corporate security world. And then also I would say networking is definitely very important. And like Maria had mentioned, sometimes it's a little daunting to just kind of reach out to someone, but that's pretty much what I had to do. Found some people on LinkedIn, just sent them like a little message. You know, usually people are very, very helpful, because this field is like, you know, it's very new, and also it's a bit secretive, I would say. Like, you know, it's not something that's super advertised. For example, you know, on the government end of things, you know, usually they have recruiters come out, but it's not so much the same thing on the corporate end, at least in my experience. So I'd say definitely networking and getting a part of those professional organizations is very helpful.
Great. And then last but not least, Claire, how about you come on in?
Hi, my name is Claire Gaynor, and I graduated from the Committee on International Relations in 2012. So I'm a few more years out of school than most of you guys. I was also part of CPOST, and I agree it was very helpful in preparing for the professional world. I'm currently a senior anti-money laundering investigator at BMO Harris Bank in Chicago. As far as how to prepare for that, I would say, since there is no such thing as an AML major, the biggest thing you can do is study up on anti-money laundering regulations and money laundering itself. The more you know about how to commit the crime, the more you know about how to prevent it and identify it. And then emphasize your transferable skills. So something that you will have learned at UChicago in grad school, I'm sorry, my cat is sneezing, is how to do independent research. And that is crucial to the world of AML. So if you can explain how that transfers, you can get your foot in the door in the AML industry.
Great. Well, I'll go ahead and introduce myself. And since I'm apparently the only person who works for the U.S. government, which is a little unusual in an intelligence and risk analysis field, I'll delve a speak a little longer, I suppose. But I'm David Benson. I graduated undergraduate in 2000, after which I joined the U.S. military. I was a Chinese linguist. I learned Chinese through the Defense Language Institute. Then I was commissioned as an infantry officer, because Chinese has a lot of use in the infantry, of course, and was given an opportunity to deploy to Iraq. There, I was able to learn Arabic. When I got out, I worked for the Joint IED Defeat Organization in an intelligence analysis capacity. Actually, in intelligence analysis and instruction was pretty much 50% of the job, because a lot of people don't really understand how intelligence works. So I got to explain to them how to make requests and these kinds of things. I then went to the University of Chicago for an undergraduate, a graduate degree at the Committee on International Relations, where I met and started working with Bob Pape, a Chicago project on, at the time, suicide terrorism, and it has now changed its name twice since I left. I rolled straight from CIR into a PhD program and completed my PhD in 2015. I did a postdoctoral year, so a few of you are postdocs. I went to the Southern Methodist University, where I had my postdoctoral appointment in the computer science department with Taylor. I forgot Taylor's last name. And Josh Rovner in the political science department. Josh is now over at American University. And I have worked at Air University, the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies, for about 4 years. It'll be 4 years in June. SAS is what is called an ASG, an Advanced Studies group, where students can get master's degrees. It's like a policy school. We have mid-level Air Force officers, and one of the questions we were asked to answers, what do you like most about your work? That's definitely it. I've got great students who are super responsive. I would say that if you are a PhD student, of which whom we have, and you are not seriously looking at any of the military not necessarily the academies, although the academies do count in this, but looking to the PMEs, the war colleges, the advanced studies groups, you're not serious about a job in academia. We've had at least two jobs in political science or history listed every year here, two every year. And we just hired three people at SAS. The opportunities for jobs in the national security education realm are overwhelming, especially when compared to other PhD options. To prepare for either as a faculty or to go into intelligence analysis, I would give, one is, doing general things is nice, and having a general idea of things is good, but getting the job, you need to be able to show things. So if you can take a specific course that gets you a credential, or even just having the course on your resume, that's helpful. Publications, whether it's as an academic or non-academic, is also helpful. So anything that says, hey, here's something I've done, whether it's publishing in Slate or Journal of Strategic Studies or any of the things that somebody might publish, that gives you some sort of imprimatur of, I actually know how to do this. Language. If you can pass a language exam, and you have to be able to pass the language exam, which whether it's because you speak English or you you speak another language, or you don't speak English as a native language, you need to be able to pass the exam one way or the other. GIS skills are in short supply, so whether it's ArcGIS or other more general. Statistical analysis can always help you, but you have to be able to speak to that in a way that relates to folks who don't necessarily understand it. So decision makers are the people who are going to hire often these folks, whether it's a military decision maker or a government decision maker or even a business decision maker. You have to be able to explain to them why your statistical analysis tools are appropriate in a way that they're going to understand. And they're not idiots, but showing them a proof is not going to help. Network analysis is another tool that is incredibly useful. And non-quantitative skills are great as well, but again, with the being able to prove that you've done it, there's going to be 1,000 resumes, especially as we go into this almost assured recession. You're going to see more and more resumes coming on across these desks. And the University of Chicago, I'll go get you all the way there. So if you're going to say that I know how to talk to people from sub-Saharan Africa, you need to show something that does that. And the So whether it's a publication or a project that you've been a part of, as I said, I was part of CPost. That is definitely a step in that right direction. And just to go back again to the academics for people who are interested in working at military programs, we hire pretty much any social science, any natural science has a chance of getting a job. But what is going to matter is that you're able to teach the courses that people need to have. We have plenty of time to do research. We have plenty of opportunity. Funding is never a problem. So research is great, but you need to be able to show that you can teach the courses. So whether that's having taught a course, TA'd courses, or that you have, again, published something, there are lots of military journals that are honestly relatively easy to get published in. So publishing something on your field in how that relates to strategy in some way shows that you can talk to these audiences. So I think that, do we have anything that any of the panelists want to add before we go to questions?
No, I think one thing that is probably a very big distinguishing factor between public versus private is just the timelines. So for example, if you are interested in going into one of the intelligence services within the government, just know that even if you are thinking about it now, that might not happen for 12 to 16 to 18 months. Whereas for the private sector, it does move a bit quickly. So you can apply to a job and be there in a few weeks. So just something to consider as you're beginning to search for jobs.
Excellent. Well, we have some questions, and you guys can, I believe the panelists can also see the questions so far. We've got two, so go ahead and throw your questions up here because I want to make sure we get everybody's questions answered. The first one relates to security clearances, and I'll answer from a government perspective, and then I'll throw it to you guys. Teaching at war colleges or universities usually requires a secret security clearance, which is fairly easy to come by as long as you don't have anything really dramatic in your background. And even if you do, as long as you tell the truth in the investigation, it's usually okay. Top secret security clearances are only required in certain positions. And that can be more difficult to acquire, but most of the time, what will happen is the job will be listed either that you are eligible, which as educators, you just have to be eligible. Intel analysts, often they want you to have a security clearance beforehand. And that is sometimes a challenge. So you have to look for jobs where the eligibility is the only thing that is required. And that means that you don't have like a pending criminal case or something like that. As far as the specific jobs, can international students have these jobs? From my perspective, yes, we have a Swedish national currently on faculty, but it varies from position to position. That's the sort of thing that you want to ask. So the question to the panel, are security cleared? I suspect that certain companies may not have the same security clearance process as the U.S. government, but maybe something else. And what about being a non-American citizen or international student?
I think I can start off. So I, for most of my current career, I was not a U.S. citizen. So I can speak from my experience. You don't need a security clearance. I think there are definitely in the field, there are some sort of positions that require that, but I think it's pretty rare unless you're working for a defense company, at least from the entry level, you know, mid-level positions. I think the only maybe limitation sometimes there could be is that my position, for example, entails a lot of interfacing with law enforcement, with, you know, the State Department, for most of those events, you don't need to be a U.S. citizen, but I have seen sometimes that there's a limitation on maybe what kind of training you can receive. But honestly, I think it's a really good field for people who are looking to do this kind of intelligence analysis, but just don't happen to be U.S. citizens.
Yeah, and I can jump on off of that. Simple answer is no. My particular position does not require a security clearance. As Yulia mentioned, if it is a private company that has government contracts in the defense world, typically you will need that. So something like Boeing. I know that some of their positions do require a secret clearance, not a top secret clearance. But as a very global company, McDonald's has a extremely large international workforce, both in the United States as well as abroad, a very extensive expat program. So that has never been an issue from our end.
Yeah, and then also jumping off of that, you know, like both Maria and Yulia said, it kind of would, you know, short answer, no, you don't generally need one. But like they said, if there's some type of contract that comes in, that, you know, that's, you know, based with like a police department or government, then usually they'll only have people who do have clearances work on those, depending on what level it is. I can't speak to other organizations, but with Hillard Hines, we do have a lot of ex-government people or who worked with pretty high up in like police departments, Secret Service, all that. So a lot of them come with, you know, security clearances. So they are the only ones who are reserved to work on those contracts that come in from the government or, like I said, police departments. So,
From the banking perspective, since we do deal with people's financial information and a lot of very sensitive data, the background check process is a little bit more intense. Not really intense, but I've been fingerprinted more times than I can count. I previously worked for a company that was licensed as a PI firm, and there's a state licensure that goes with that. As David said, don't lie on your background check form. If there's nothing to do with financial crime or violent crime in your past, you're probably going to be fine.
Great. The just a fun story that I know about security clearances. I've known two people who didn't get security clearances because of what came out on their background check. One, somebody was lying. The other, it turned out that his mother was a half-sister of Osama bin Laden, and she didn't even know. So, but other than that, as long as you're telling the truth, you're fine. The next question we have up here, and I'll just throw this to you guys. You know, what did you wish you had learned while you were at the University of Chicago? Hard skills or soft skills? I'm not sure what the distinction you would make would be, but the, you know, what do you wish you had done?
I'll take this if you don't mind. So when you're in university, you're going to have your papers read and attention paid to you because basically you're paying to go there. When you are in the professional world, the people whose attention you want to get are extremely busy. And if you want them to take your findings seriously, you need to be able to make a really concise case as to why you have found something that is important, that's urgent, that's a security concern. So being able to get to that bottom line and being able to show what the impact is to the company is going to push you forward in your career and make it so that all the work that you do has an impact.
And I can jump in next. One thing that I wished I had learned maybe a little bit better was how to speak the language of business. So I think for the most part, we were all soft sciences, whether it was international relations or political science. But in the security field, particularly in a corporate environment, they don't understand but they don't have the same sense of importance for certain security developments. And so it really does take a lot of practice and patience and time to speak the business language, to translate how this security concern or how this risk will impact the business writ large. And I don't know if that's something you can learn in a classroom setting. You really do need to be thrown into the thick of things to practice that. But understanding, okay, I might be a Middle Eastern studies person. I know everything about the Middle East. But for the senior leadership at McDonald's, they know the business. And so understanding how is it that your particular skill set and your knowledge base can feed into the concerns and the questions that the senior leadership has and the company as a whole is very helpful. And just takes a quite a bit of time and practice.
Mm-hmm. And then also similarly, I'd say, you know, I came out of the social sciences school and Middle Eastern studies program, and that's a lot of paper writing and it's a lot of fluff. So I'd say, you know, learning how to like cut that fluff and just kind of like get quickly to like whatever point that you're trying to make. And then as Claire said earlier as well, like just kind of getting to the point and then, you know, framing whatever issue or whatever thing that you think might be an issue, making sure that it's heard in a way that they can digest it and understand, and kind of just really being an advocate for it, because, you know, it could be an issue to you, but like might not be as big of a deal to them, but maybe later down the line, it might be something that they might have missed. So it's kind of, you know, your job to make sure that you stress the importance of this, even if it's, you know, it seems small, but you think there might be something here, just like holding on to that nugget and making sure that, you know, your senior management is able to pick that up and you relay it to them.
And if I can just jump in, I really could not agree more with everything we said before me. I think one important thing, and just jumping off what Maria mentioned, the ability to speak the business language. It can come when you're in school. It can come from a couple of sources. First is, of course, networking with the people who work in the field, because you will start, as you talk to a couple of people, you'll start noticing that they're mentioning even the same terms. And so also it's important, so when you're interviewing, applying for the job, that you're speaking exactly the same language you're speaking in those terms. Additionally, I think with these intelligence analysis, political risk analysis, you can find analysis or consultancies online that provide some sort of freebies, that their reports that you can read and look at how they're looking at the same developments that you might be looking, let's say, in the Middle East, but also how they're framing the business impact. As part of the preparatory work, I've had a mentor that told me to read also the Wall Street Journal and Financial Times to see how they're covering international developments, because obviously as commercial publications, that's their primary concern. I also, as a second point, I definitely agree with getting to the bottom line, elaborating on the impact and eliminating all the fluff that you can from your writing, be it before you start writing or after you start writing. Sometimes it's just much easier to write a long paper, long-winded paper, and then cut it down completely and rephrase it and put your bottom line up front. One thing in that regard that I actually don't wish I had done, but I'm happy that I had done when during my year at the University of Chicago, was taking the Little Red Schoolhouse academic and professional writing program. I think it's probably was the most useful course that, at least in professional terms, that I have ever taken. And I use those skills that I've acquired from them to this day to both critique other people's writing, edit, copy, edit other people's writing, as well as my own. So I think that's another useful course that you can take while you're in grad school.
Yeah, I'll just throw in on that, and then we'll move on to the next question. I train mid-level career officers and government folks, and writing, people don't know how to write. The ability to write something is amazing. And I've worked with people who, you know, with the media, things like War on the Rocks and Real Clear Defense. I actually had a piece out there a couple days ago, and they struggle to get people who can write just seven paragraphs that make any sense. So that is an unsung skill.
David, your mic is muted again. Sorry.
I'm going to combine two questions we have here that I think are related. One is, what does your day look like? How much is research? How much is in person? How much is travel, work-life balance? And then what do you like most about your jobs?
I can start that one off. Today and this past few weeks have been very different than what I think the average day-to-day looks like at McDonald's. So as I had mentioned, our focus primarily is on brand and reputation risk. So as a very well-known Western company, there are lots of groups who don't particularly appreciate all that the Golden Arches might have to offer. So a day-to-day in a normal non-coronavirus environment would involve a lot of research and background on these particular groups who continue to actively target the brand. And as Taylor had mentioned, we do have POI, so persons of interest lists, and make sure that for any senior leadership attended events that these persons or groups who have targeted the company in the past are either not hoping to attend or will infiltrate any sort of event. But in addition to that, keeping up with a lot of the geopolitical activity that occurs worldwide. So while we don't currently have a very strong relationship with our supply chain, because the franchise model of the company just really messes things up. We do, of course, have contacts all across the world that if an issue were to require some sort of intelligence deliverable, then they reach out to us. So it is a bit more ad hoc. And one thing that I really do appreciate is that at least as an intelligence advisor, we actually are not called analysts at McDonald's. It really is customer facing engagement. So while we might spend 2 or 3 hours doing research and writing up proposals and documents to circulate, we really do engage with our key customers and key stakeholders much more readily than we are actually sitting behind a computer and writing and researching these documents. And I think that would actually be my most favorite part about the job is that if you like structure and routine and want to know, okay, you go in at 8 a.m. and you're going to sit at the computer and write for 8 hours and then leave, that's not the job for you, at least in McDonald's context. You never really know what to expect sometimes. Your boss can come in and put an intel requirement at your desk and be like, okay, you have 4 hours. Tell me everything that you can about this particular group and any of the efforts that they are pursuing to target the brand. So having a bit flexibility and room for creativity in the job is something that I'm very grateful for.
I can jump in next. So I would say probably day-to-day is not the best format that I think about my work. It's probably week-to-week because I do have a weekly deliverable. It's sort of a newsletter, but it's a little more analytical than just most people's. When people hear the word newsletter, what they think of. That includes the important trends and events around the world that may have an impact in the going forward on the company's operations and maybe what we are doing as, you know, global security, but also other parts of the organization, because we are maintaining ties with them to understand how they're managing certain situations, how they look at risk, and so on and so forth. Just as Maria mentioned, a very, very key part of my job is stakeholder engagement. So it's basically nurturing those relations with people in the supply chain, with people in public relations, with different affiliates as well. It unfortunately does not include as much, my particular position does not include as much travel as I would like to engage with some of those people in person. So you also learn how to try to work in this multinational company and support those virtual relationships, which is another challenge. In addition to that, of course, day-to-day, a big part of my job is just looking through all the important intelligence fields, open sources, because without the knowledge of what is going on, I'm not able to, even if I can't, you know, necessarily write about it, I can't apply, I can't really say that my analysis is pertinent to people, that it's up to date. In addition to that, is really a day-to-day is very different. So we do get a lot of requests, be they from maybe a group of travelers who are going to a certain country and have heard about a development, be they from the executives who were, for some reason, decide to ask certain things. And again, sometimes it could be very mysterious. And sometimes you even have to reframe the question because an executive is concerned about something, but then you realize, well, they shouldn't be concerned about this. They should actually be concerned about this in an X country, and so on and so forth. So it's a lot of, definitely a lot of writing, but probably not as much as you would think. So also a lot of that relationship development, monitoring what's happening around the world and taking notes. So yeah, that's it for me.
Yeah, and then I can jump in here. So pretty much like, you know, my day-to-day, if I could, you know, nail it down to what I do generally, I'd say a lot of it is research. And a lot of it is just based on specifically whatever our clients want. And I mentioned before, the bulk of our clients are very like high wealth. So they have very specific ideas about what they want as far as like monitoring. So I'd say monitoring is a lot of what we do. And that could be, and generally what we're looking for are like physical threats and threats to brand, but actually not so much threats to brand, really more physical and like legal threats. So that just could be maybe, for example, one of our clients has a person of interest that has been making threatening comments online, has threatened to like come on site or has even been monitored to be around the site and or is trying to set up like protests, things like that. So we have kind of, we just use open source techniques to monitor them, just do like a full background. And that's kind of where our like investigation sides of things come in. So a lot of it is that, just making sure that whatever, you know, this could be one POI, this could be a group of people, this could be like a movement that's, you know, spreading via like Twitter or like whatever avenue it's spreading through. So a lot of that, a lot of it is that, is keeping up with that and then doing weekly reports, daily reports, whatever specifications that the client wants. So I'd say that takes up kind of the bulk of like what we do. And I'd say actually it's pretty interesting because it varies day to day. Like you never know like what kind of something's going to pop off, like some fire, and you have to like put it out, make sure, you know, whatever that you're monitoring is, you know, oh, this is probably not a big deal, but then also like, you know, other little things where you're like, yeah, this could kind of like spark a fire. Like it could be, for example, someone saying like, oh, like, I don't know, some CEO, and you're like, they just have some comment on Twitter and they're like, yeah, I'm gonna go, you know, start a protest here. You know, it could just be one little off comment, but then that can start building fires, that it builds into this thing. And then before you know it, you've got 1,000 people showing up at, you know, this guy's home that they've somehow figured out where it's at. So it's like picking up on little nuggets like that and monitoring them. And, you know, maybe it's not something you need to bring to the client's attention initially, but something that you need to just kind of keep following up on to make sure that it's not going to turn into something huge. So I'd say like bulk of what we do is that, you know, there's not that much travel, but as Maria and Yulia said, it's also alternatively a lot of keeping up with, you know, our stakeholders, keeping up with our clients, reassuring them that, you know, if they have issues, they could be even the smallest thing. It could be like, maybe they got a robocall from some call center in India and they're concerned about it, but generally it means nothing. But just making sure you're reassuring their, you know, anxieties, their fears, and all that. So I'd say that kind of takes up the bulk of what we do day to day. But you know, it varies. It definitely varies depending on the project. And sometimes there's a lot of crossover between departments. So maybe our threat and security design department might need some help from our threat and violence assessment team. So there's a lot of crossover. So really your day-to-day could be different, you know, based on the weeks, based on how many projects we're getting in. you know, it really varies, but I'd say that's the bulk, a lot of research and just investigating online.
Yeah, I'll just add that government intelligence analysis often involves more travel, it seems, than non-government. I don't know why that is. That may, in fact, change because of the pandemic. But you can look at if travel is something that you're concerned about doing, like you don't want to do it, or you do want to do it, they'll usually have a listing and they'll say 25, 50, 75% travel. You know, you'll see down to 10 or 5%, which means that periodic. And then working in education, you travel more or less as much or as little as you want to. So, you know, I get to travel as much as I want. And that's kind of nice. But there are people who don't travel at all. So we have a very popular question here about how the pandemic is going to affect hiring. So do you guys think that it's going to change hiring in your companies?
I can start off. I did notice the question also mentioned, you know, if people are hiring, and I can speak to that. I've seen actually over the past few days, quite a few positions opened up in peer companies. So I think at least so far, it's not affecting hiring as much. On the other hand, for those companies that I know, there's a lot of big companies, and our jobs involve working at large multinational corporations. So a lot of them do have troubles currently. However, I think for those companies that do stay open, the value of intelligence analysis during the pandemic is becoming more and more clear. So, you know, maybe, and I don't know how much that's going to affect hiring in the next few months, but I think possibly this is actually going to open up a lot more opportunities at different companies that are realizing, oh, well, we don't have a person who can really effectively work with information and help us navigate this crisis in which everyone, and even at my company, everyone who is not a professional like that is definitely overwhelmed.
So within the field of money laundering, banks are actually required by the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970 to have an AML department, which means that these jobs are always going to exist. If you want to look for an institution that is specifically going to have openings, look for banks that have recently gotten into trouble with the Treasury Department's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, because they will be running remediation programs to look back and see what did we do wrong that caused a case or a bad actor to slip through the cracks.
And I think I am just as optimistic as Julia for not seeing too much of an impact, hopefully, at least to the corporate security realm. One thing to note, though, is that it will vary by industry. So, for example, I don't think any of the airlines or hospitality industry or tourism industry specific to the corporate security realm are going to be actively looking to expand their teams. Unfortunately, because of this crisis, there have been massive layoffs and unfortunately, from a business perspective, the security realm is a cost center. You are not bringing in money to the company. You are spending all of their money. So even as a big company as McDonald's, we do not have access to some of the resources that might appear prevalent. So just being cognizant of particular industries within the private security realm will help guide finding some of those opportunities and hopefully the near future.
So, you know, the government is always hiring. They print the money so they don't run out of it. I'll just add a few, just a couple of things. When I graduated undergraduate, was right at the trough of the financial collapse, and my options or completely ran out. I enlisted in the Army, and that's how I learned Chinese and Arabic, and that's how I got my security clearance. And it's three things that I say are the three most important decisions I ever made in my life, and I don't regret it one bit. Now, if had I died in a deployment, I might have felt, I might feel differently about that. But the, well, I wouldn't feel differently. It would just be different. But the, if joining the military is something you're thinking about, it is a great way into government intelligence analysis. But I strongly suspect that you, like, one, if you're grad, a grad student, that it was hard for me as a, graduate to swallow my pride. And as a grad student, I know that it can be a bit of a hit, but that that's something that it really is valuable, especially if you can get into a field that you want to do. They pay the amount of money that you can be paid to learn something you want to learn anyway, like Chinese or to be a pilot, or to get skills in intelligence analysis is really quite impressive. And in enlistment, they'll pay off your student loans, which is pretty great. The another area where it is a growth, intelligence and analysis in the public in general is a growth area, I think. But the someplace that honestly, with almost no qualifications whatsoever, if you other than an ability to read and write, you can get a pretty decent job is intelligence analyst related to cybersecurity threats. Right now, there's jobs, and this will never go away. You can work from home. The cybersecurity threats are going through the roof, especially now as people are, you know, who knows, somebody might be hacking this conversation right now. Why, I don't know. But the it's something that increasingly companies are monitoring and they're paying for. And since there is very little in the way of established licensure and practices, it's pretty easy to break into. All you really need to do is start subscribing to these newsletters and reading up on sort of things. And some of those skills that I told you about, like language, where, you know, that's part of the way that they discover who's behind activities. Computer programming is helpful, but not required. Area studies are helpful, but not required. And basic causal inference and logical thinking and again writing, and you'll have a pretty good shot at it. So I think that that's a private avenue that people are going to be going on. And I would just add that we will have a job opening listed at our university. You know, look at USA Jobs, and there will be jobs. There will be jobs. So it's one of those things. Did anybody have anything else they wanted to add before we move on to another topic? All right. So we've got a few questions on themes, areas, and the specific issues or areas of study. So one, I'm just going to go in order down this list. One is, how important do you think geographic areas, or is regional expertise valued in the field?
I could jump in here. So as being a graduate of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, and then applying to this field, I felt like it was very helpful. I mean, any type of like area studies, I think, because it teaches you to be very like nuanced, but also, you know, shows that you can like hunker down and focus on like one area set, but also, you know, be able to expand out of that. And language skills, as David has mentioned and others have mentioned, language skills always like very important. Though I wouldn't say that I use, I mean, I can speak, I learned Farsi, so I'd say I'm like pretty fluent, almost native level. I don't use it in my everyday today, but I never know when I will need it. Sometimes there have been tweets or there have been stuff posted online that's loosely related to maybe a client and they want to know what's being said here. And then that's just something I could easily do. Just, you just kind of never know where the connection might come in. We could get a client that, for example, they could be Iranian, American, or whatever, and maybe they're having some kind of issues, and they might need someone to translate. You know, it could happen, might, maybe not, but it's always something good to have, you know, even if, whether, whatever language it is, may it be Chinese, like Arabic, and just even in general, I think, you know, people always look favorably on the fact that if you can learn a language or you know, you have a certain amount of knowledge about something, because it shows that you're able to, like I said, dial in and focus in on, you know, a topic that they might need you to. So I always say very helpful language, area knowledge. I'd say it will look very favorably upon you.
I can. Go ahead, Yula.
Go ahead, Claire.
In AML, we don't focus on specific geographical regions, but we do focus on specific industries. So I'm in the bank's high-risk unit, and I review customer activity for customers that have been identified as inherently high-risk. On my team, we do cryptocurrency, we do gun stores, auto dealerships. What was the other big one? Cannabis. So you learn what the red flags are specifically in those industries and what normal activity looks like and what abnormal activity looks like so that you can follow those trends down to a specific action or a problem that might need to be escalated.
Right, and I'll jump in now. So in my field, it varies from company to company. So I would definitely say regional expertise would be a definite value add at some companies where they have analysts who are concentrated or focused on certain regions. I mentioned before that one of my first positions was working as an EMEA analyst, the Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. So definitely knowing, speaking two European languages was helpful for me in securing that position. At the same time, as if you notice, the regions are usually so broadly defined. So whether I'm an expert in Europe, I need to be able to go ahead and learn about the Middle East or Africa, which you, as you can imagine, is two completely different regions from Europe. In my current position, I am a global analyst. My company has offices and at least physical presence in more than 70 countries around the world. So you also need to be able to really be flexible. And some of the skills that you learn in grad school is, as for example, learning about a new topic very fast is super useful. I would say languages, unfortunately, aren't, so they occasionally come up, just as Taylor mentioned, the need to, let's say I was working on a project that had, or on the research project that had to do with Russia, so definitely speaking Russian was super useful for that one project, but in my 3 years of working at this company, that was the only one. And then maybe some occasional articles and write-ups I did were useful, my language knowledge was useful for. I would say it's also the regional expertise is also very useful in our field as we work at multinational companies in terms of showing that you've gone out and learned something outside of your place or, outside of where you were born, outside of where you've lived, having that cultural expertise and also interest and curiosity about other places. That also goes for learning languages, because as you learn other languages, you also learn culture. So that's also super useful, whether you're a regional analyst or whether you're a global analyst.
Yeah, and just one quick point. Most people, including myself, are surprised to find out that McDonald's is not broken down by geographic area. They're broken down by the type of license that the market has. So because of the franchise model, it's essentially a bunch of smaller private businesses. So in terms of geographic area, you can have four different types of markets in one country. So that was something that I am still learning. So there are three of us on our team who are global intelligence advisors. So while I have more familiarity with the Middle East, my colleague has Latin America and another colleague in Africa and Asia. Our particular roles are not limited to that, but playing on each other's strengths has definitely proven very helpful And while it is not a requirement, of course, as all of the panelists have mentioned, it is extremely helpful, particularly with these multinational corporations. If I speak Arabic and I have a colleague based out of the Dubai office, it would make more sense for me to speak with them than for my colleague who is the Latin American expert. So not necessary, but definitely proves helpful to relate to business needs.
Just to quickly add on that, I was actually yesterday on the call with a lot of people from Latin America, and the tendency that you would notice is that it always feels really bad not to speak Spanish being in the United States. Yeah. And that a lot of people, they understand and they know English, but they're so much more comfortable speaking in Spanish, for example. So. Exactly. In terms of developing those stakeholder relations, speaking another language, relationships, speaking in those languages could be really useful.
And I think in government in general, if you want to know how the government breaks things down, major commands that the military has is a pretty reasonable way to do that. That one thing that bears pointing out is that there's two ways to look at it, which I think Yulia was getting at, which is one is as partnerships and one is as a subject of analysis. In terms of subject of analysis, we probably will always have enough people who are experts in Western Europe. That's pretty easy to get people who know a lot about. And North America, we live here, you know, America does. So Mexico, Canada, not hard to find people. Relative advantages, almost never have enough East Asia, Southeast Asia. Better in the Middle East, Sub-Saharan Africa, not hardly any, easier to find jobs in that. Latin America, especially Central and South America, is tougher to find an analyst that really knows stuff about that. But even if I know about Western Europe, well, we have lots of Western European partners, and working with them is important. So the next question is about economics, and we got a couple of financial analysts. The question was actually directed to you, Yulia, just to everybody, how important would you say economics is, and is that valuable, or more specifically, I think the question might have been meant is, if you don't know it, would you be okay? Or, and if you do know it, how good is that?
So I'll start off. So I do know a little bit of economics. It's very useful because definitely as you're trying to tease out the trends that are going on, even, within countries, so those socioeconomic trends, knowing something about economics is definitely useful, and also being able to look at indicators like inequality, like poverty rates, and so on and so forth. But it always, for my profession, it always, of course, applies to as far as how is this going to drive political instability? How is this going to drive civil unrest? How is this going to drive crime, and so on and so forth. So I think economics is very useful, just as long as you're able to apply it in a multidisciplinary context.
Understanding how small businesses work can definitely help you in the world of AML, especially because those are considered more risky because we have less insight into what they're doing because they're not large and publicly traded. So also understanding the news, there was a question earlier about COVID-19. We've already received guidance from higher ups about some red flags to look for when we get to reviewing activity that will occur during that period. We're expecting to see certain changes like increased cash activity. We certainly don't want to see people selling masks, so we'll be on the lookout for that. So as Yulia said, understanding the news, understanding economic basics is going to help you.
Yeah, just from a macro level, understanding, of course, in-country dynamics as it relates to their economies is very obviously useful. Again, McDonald's is a very widely known and very large corporation, and so has the ability to wipe out entire industries of small, like, for example, in Chicago, so many small restaurants, private businesses are closing simply because of our current economic situation. So really understanding how our business gets implicated in that process is helpful. Again, the finance team has much more knowledge about that than I do, but understanding from a macro scale how it implicates the business is very useful.
Great. So we have a couple of other questions. I'm going to merge two questions together related to natural sciences. So we have one about physics here specifically, physics and space science, or science diplomacy. Have you seen any of that arise in your, you know, where that would be useful or how you could map that on or any overlap with that?
My initial response, working in a fast food industry, is no. But we do have a large team of specifically chemists that work with the company as a whole, and they specifically work at Hamburger University, and there's multiple universities for that around the world. So from a security science blended perspective, there could be a nexus there, but not enough that I would know to talk about beyond we have a very impressive chemist team.
I'll jump in. So my first initial reaction was also no, but I think it's more about using those skills that you've probably learned as a physicist. Yes, I hope I'm getting the right profession here. So for example, I'm sure any physicist is good with data science. That could be something that's actually very useful in our profession. I would say I am more, unfortunately, of a qualitative analyst at this point, but as time goes by, you're starting to see that the companies really want to bring in those people that have those kinds of quantitative skills. At the same time, you're also probably very good at looking at studies, and as the COVID, and this is not necessarily a relationship, but just to give you one example, even if you're, for example, a medical or biomedical student, advanced degree student, you probably know very well how to look at modeling, which is something that we right now as intelligence analysts are looking at and trying to make sense of. And it's important for us to understand those trends and to be able to tell decision makers whether this modeling is necessarily going to tell them what's going to happen in the future, for example. So I think there's a lot of transferable skills that could be used in our profession from a very hard sciences background.
Well, I'll say that it absolutely, we have a lot of this. I guess we differ from the civilian world in this way. Just to speak to the physics and space, you know, you may have heard we've got a new space force. I don't know what they've settled on, but I'm going to call them space cadets. This is one of our most recent hires was a space expert. What we were specifically looking for. And so that is, now we were looking for space law, space history, but a lot of these other things, we did look at a historian, a physicist in that, and that was for a professor position. So space science is a big issue. Space diplomacy is a big issue. Science diplomacy, one of the places that I see this come up a lot, and if you're looking for specific recommendations, the Department of State, the Department of Treasury, and the Department of Justice all deal with this a lot, and we're looking at especially diffusion of technologies. So both positive, we want it to diffuse, so development and things like that, and negative, we don't want people to know how we encrypt our stuff. With back to the physics issue, I've known a number of physicists who may very successfully made the transition to data science. It's a very good way to do that. That's again a growth industry. The math training that you have in that, the one of the best network analysis analysts that I ever knew was somebody who actually had gotten a PhD in crystal theory, and a lot of the math is exactly the same. So there's a lot of room for these kinds of things in the government. Diplomacy is mostly handled through state, but if that's something that you're interested in researching, I think is definitely a growth industry as far as that goes as well. We are coming up. We've got 10 minutes, and I got a question here that I think is a good way to bring it home. Which is, what is the biggest challenge, most annoying thing about your job? And if we can wrap up no later than 10, 10, 17, 18, then we'll put a fork in it and call it good. So what's the biggest and most annoying thing about your job?
This is recorded. I'm kidding. I can start. I think one thing that is very challenging is sometimes understanding the politics between certain decisions or certain processes and procedures. And I think because our field specifically is so interdisciplinary, we think that, okay, you can very easily just access the subject matter expert in one particular issue area, talk to them, work through a problem set or work through, an intel requirement and just push it along. That's not always the case. There's a lot of steps that sometimes need to be taken in avenues and particular people and titles who need to have visibility and access to move things along. So kind of the bureaucratic processes also that are necessary. And it's just something that I think is present in any corporation, any business, whether it's private or public sector, but just being a little bit patient and taking the time to really understand the dynamics of your organization can be a little bit more frustrating than might initially come across.
And then I can jump in here. I'd probably say the most challenging thing, which is the core of the job and what you're hired to do, which also makes it very fulfilling, is that you have a lot of pressure and say so like on your shoulders. So the core of it is that you are trying to prevent disasters. You're trying to prevent these threats from penetrating whatever client or corporation or whatever. So a lot is riding on your analysis and a lot is riding on, what you're advising. So I'd say paying attention, as I mentioned before many times, like the very small details that tend to snowball into bigger issues. Because if you miss something and, you're, like I said, you're hired to do this job, first thing you're going to hear is from your stakeholders. And even if it's not a huge disaster in the sense I used an example earlier, where someone's protesting maybe around the corporation's, headquarters. I mean, that's a pretty big thing. And if you've missed that, that's a huge thing. But even imagining you've missed a POI or you've missed something that, you would have normally reported. And then before you know it, they are like on site and it could lead to even a bigger issue. We've seen where we've had either on campus shootings, shootings at corporations, people, there's just, like I said, small information that's missed can just turn into like a huge problem. So I think that is one of the challenging things is then being able to, day to day, not miss things, to be like super detail oriented and all that. So I'd say that's probably the most challenging because, you're pretty much the layer between potential disasters. But as I said before, that's what the job is. And it's very like fulfilling when you do catch those things and you've prevented something possibly catastrophic. But even the smaller scale things too, you know, it's just very, very rewarding to then be able to be like, hey, we noticed this thing. We think you'd be concerned about it. It could turn into this. It might not turn into this, but just as long as you're aware. So I'd say that's probably the most challenging part.
Okay, I'll start. So in my role, I would say there's so many challenging things, but one of the most challenging, of course, as being a global analyst is to set priorities on how I'm doing my monitoring, what I'm reporting, as well as what I'm reporting about. I do have that fear, just as Taylor, I was always missing something. But of course, as you get more comfortable in your role, you start to understand, well, you know, maybe this little protest in France or I don't know, in Germany where it's all peaceful, should not be communicated to people. I should not be spending my time doing that. And then maybe this trend is actually much more important. So setting priorities is key. Another challenging part is as I work in the corporate security department, there's still a perception in the company, and I think it's a challenge in a lot of companies for similar positions. There's a perception that we are kind of security guards, you know, cameras, that we can't provide the sort of analysis that would be insightful. And it's always perceived as a cost to the company, as opposed to something that might help enable business. So one of the more challenging things, again, for me, is to try to shift that perception and provide analysis that doesn't just say, well, we can't do this because this country is too dangerous, but also say, no, we can go and open an office in this country just as long as we understand the security environment in which I try to enable and show those opportunities as well as risks.
To sort of go off of what Julia and Taylor said, the biggest challenge is probably not becoming complacent. There was an incident where another investigator had cleared an import-export company, said that their activity was normal and fine. I dug a little bit deeper into who they were doing business with and into some of the suspicious cash activity, and they were running a drug operation. And of course, that had to be referred to law enforcement. So it wasn't AML specifically, but you find all kinds of things when you start digging into people's financial activity. So, you know, not knowing that you could maybe log off at 5 if you kind of check the boxes and say, okay, I looked at the sources I needed to look at, you could do that. But if there's something in the back of your mind that says, hey, what's going on here? This is a little bit vague. This is a little bit strange. Going that extra mile, digging in a little bit deeper, it's going to set you apart and you're going to find things that really matter.
Well, I'll finish it out with, for me, the way that I think of this is that there are two kinds of people, or at least on a spectrum. On one side, you have people who are very self-motivated, but like to work in a flat organization, you know, the knights errant, the people who like to go out and find causes and whatnot. And we have a lot of those at the University of Chicago. So there's a good chance that that's one of you, or you fall closer to this spectrum. The other side are people who really like rules, organization, and hierarchy. And if you're most of the intel analysts work better on this side of the spectrum. Most of the people who make decisions work better on this side of the spectrum. And working in the government, you have to, you may be taking orders from people who are on this side of the spectrum, and there's all kinds of things that you don't expect to matter and yet matter a lot to them because that's the kind of person they are. So it's important to figure out what kind of person you are and find a job that fits you well, but just understand that if you're the person who likes order and hierarchy, you're going to see all these wackies, analysts running around doing things that don't make any sense to you. And if you're one of the people who likes to be self-starting and going and but have no oversight, you're going to realize that those people are going to be like, why aren't you checking these boxes and why don't I have lists? And that's just the nature of things. Well, I'd like to thank all of our panelists, and I think we're wrapping up right about on time. If you guys have anything you wanted to add, I'll let you say it now. As far as me, feel free to reach out to me online. You can find me through a number of number of venues, including Wiser, and you know, panelists. Just go ahead and thank you very much.
Yeah, if I could just have one quick thing. If you guys are graduating or looking for jobs or whatever situation you're currently in, this environment right now of uncertainty and confusion and frustration, you guys need to give yourself a break, because it is going to be very difficult navigating what we're doing tomorrow, let alone in the next few months. So really just taking a second to appreciate how far you've come and what you really have to offer. I think one thing that was extremely frustrating was once you leave graduate school and apply to a ton of different jobs and don't hear anything back, you start to look inward and be like, well, what am I doing wrong? Like, why is it that I sent out 100 applications and no one is even giving me the time to tell me, hey, no, like, this isn't going to work out. So please, please, please just know it is not a reflection on any of you guys, but just unfortunately the circumstances that are currently plaguing us right now. So remain optimistic, remain working hard. And I think I speak for all of us, on the panel. If, you know, you need someone to talk to, you're more than welcome to reach out to any of us if you have any questions or advice. I believe most of us are on Wiser. LinkedIn is also super helpful. So again, keep your chins up and just remain optimistic moving forward.
Just to quickly piggyback off Maria's point, I think that one very positive thing that I found when I started my career is not how much I had to learn, but how much I had to bring to this position. So I think all of you graduate students probably have a lot more skills that you can even think of that are going to be, that qualify you for those jobs. All you need to do is just go that extra mile and understand how to present those skills in a way that will be understandable to people in business.
So thank you all so much for being here. This was absolutely fantastic. We do need to now wrap up the panel so that we can host the next panel meeting. So once again, thank you all so much for this. And we look forward to talking to you all again.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Bye.
See ya.